Welcome to Parents' Perspective. You're kidding! 5-year-old Sarah's and 3-year-old Ben's mom nearly shrieked into the phone. Are you sure? Well, she continued, I'm going to turn on the TV and see if they say anything on the news. I'll call you back. And this just in, said a voice from the screen. There's been a report of a case of smallpox in the town of Clearville, a suburb about 15 miles from the city. A special medical team from the city hospital is en route to Clearville Clinic, and we'll have the latest from our reporter on the scene momentarily. Hello, Myra? Sarah's mom was back on the phone. You were right. I'm not going to wait. I'm taking Sarah and Ben to the health center right away and demanding that they get shots. Better safe than sorry. I'll see you and Timmy and Zach there in a few minutes. Sarah and Ben, she called up the steps. Come on downstairs. We're going for a ride. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about national medical emergencies and what can we do for our kids? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has a national vantage point for just these kinds of issues. Dr. Joseph Wright is Medical Director for Advocacy and Community Affairs at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. He practices emergency medicine at the hospital and is an Associate Professor of Pediatrics, Emergency Medicine, and Community Health in the Schools of Medicine and Public Health at George Washington University. Dr. Wright also has 2 sons, ages 13 and 15. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Wright.
Thank you.
What kinds of scenarios would you characterize as being possible national or community medical emergencies?
Well, certainly the scenario that we just heard would give rise to an actual potential infectious disease emergency. But I think more importantly for families and parents is the reaction, the response that we heard as part of the scenario, the fear, the anxiety that's associated with the unknown. And those kinds of behaviors in families and in communities at large is part of what really makes it very challenging to think about preparedness and how families might prepare for emergencies and how the medical community might prepare for emergencies. I think it's important for parents to know that children are potentially more vulnerable than adults with regard to the chemical and bio agent from an anatomic and physiologic. If people wonder, well, why is that? Well, because of stature. For gases that are heavier than air and sink to the ground, children are closer to the ground and are at their statures right at levels where they would be breathing in heavier concentrations of gas. Also, for those agents that are absorbed through the skin, children have thinner skin, and therefore the absorption potential is greater. For those agents that depend on entry to the body through the respiratory tree, children breathe at a faster rate than adults do, and therefore are taking in potentially more of the toxic substance at a faster rate than an adult would. And also, again, just based on the developmental age of a child is not likely to be able to extricate themselves from a potentially dangerous situation.
Is there a difference between the medical facilities equipped to handle kids versus those for adults in a medical crisis?
Well, absolutely. And let's step away from the crisis scenario just for a moment to talk more generally about the differences in caring for children versus caring for adults at medical facilities. There has been for the last 20 years a defined specialty known as pediatric emergency medicine. And I had the benefit of being in sort of the first wave of pediatricians to train formally in pediatric emergency medicine, although there have been pediatricians who have been practicing in emergency departments across the country for many, many years. In 1981, represented the first time that we had formal fellowship training in a specialty. And there are presently some 1,100 pediatric emergency medicine specialists across the country. These specialists are primarily concentrated in urban academic medical centers. And as we all know, children are distributed all across the country. So there is a mismatch where the quote-unquote specialists practice and work, and the likelihood of you as a parent necessarily having access to those specialists. So one of the ways that our medical system is set up to take care of children are ill or injured is a system of regionalization. And what I mean by that is that in a regionalized trauma system, if a child is injured and needs the care of a specialist, there are systems, transport systems, referral systems to get that child to the right facility. And this exists all across the country. Actually, 61% of the population is involved or covered by a regionalized system of care whereby a child who may need specialized services can be transported rapidly to the appropriate facility. And this happens every day. Now, in the context of an emergency that may be related to a terrorism incident, an infectious disease emergency, or a chemical emergency or a radiologic emergency, those systems are vulnerable just as our communities are vulnerable, and that's the real fear. How will the infrastructure respond and deal when the infrastructure may be the target itself?
Oh, that's so frightening, but I never even thought of it that way. That's really the key.
I guess the first thing is, if I were concerned about this, I would want to know, does my community participate in a regionalized system? How would a parent know this?
And where are the 39% that aren't part of that?
I knew you were going to ask that.
First, I had to do the math. It took a few minutes.
Well, let me take the second part of that question. The 39% that don't currently participate in a statewide regionalized system, and I'm talking primarily about traumatic injuries in this instance, are located primarily in the Mountain West and more sparsely populated parts of the country. And that doesn't mean that services do not exist. They're just not organized in a regionalized fashion in which there are identified destinations and designated facilities to take care of critically ill and injured children. And with regard to the first part of the question, the best resource is always your family pediatrician. That's a question that I receive a lot in the emergency department. How can I get information about my concerns and where the resources are and how I can access resources? Well, the primary pediatrician represents the medical home for a family, and I think that the primary care pediatrician, the child's doctor who has hopefully been caring for the child on a longitudinal basis since infancy, is always the best resource. And the systems that I've been talking about are linked into the medical home system, the primary care pediatrician. Many times the people who are actually making referrals about sick kids are the primary care pediatricians themselves, and we talk with them on a regular basis. So I would consider the family pediatrician to be the best resource for knowing what the local nuances are in your community with regard to pediatric services.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on what kids need in a national medical emergency.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. Today we are talking with Dr. Joseph Wright of the Children's National Medical Center about what kids need in a national medical emergency.
I remember when my children were very young, my pediatrician said, if there's an emergency, don't go here, here, and here. And the reasoning was nothing against the hospitals. There were no emergency provisions for small children.
Yes, precisely. And that's just the kind of information that your private pediatrician is likely to know. And it differs from community to community. Certainly in the area that you're describing, there is a discrete practice or flow of children to particular institutions because of preparedness, because of equipment, because of personnel. Mm-hmm. And there are differences. Every hospital is not necessarily fully equipped to care for a critically ill child. this is something that will challenge and stress our system because, of course, when faced with a community-wide emergency, a chemical or biological or radiologic event, families are going to go to the closest facility for care. And this whole notion of regionalization and referral may not work.
I love Children's Hospital, Children's National Medical Center, but it's very far away from where I live. And so you're right. That's where I would have preferred to go, first choice for my children, but I wouldn't end up there in an emergency.
Right.
That's
right.
Tough.
So this question about where we would take a child in a national medical emergency or a community-wide medical emergency, would you recommend just going to the nearest hospital? I can imagine the pediatrician switchboards are going to light up like Christmas trees, so you wouldn't be able to get through. So the question is, what would you say to do? You know, here's a panicked mother in this story.
Sure.
And what would you say to do?
It's kind of hard to predict behavior in the artificial environment of a scenario. Let me perhaps talk about what our experience was on September 11th, 2001, and what we were thinking about and what was going through our minds with regard to our role, not only for our institution, but the surrounding community and the surrounding region. On that day, we were actually the only tertiary care children's hospital in the country that had that level of alert. There were fortunately no children involved in the World Trade Center catastrophe, and at the Pentagon, the only children lost were those aboard American Airlines Flight 11. However, just halfway around the Pentagon was a daycare center, was the employee daycare center.
Of course.
So as we stood ready at our facility, not knowing, I mean, this is all in retrospect now, we realize how close the impact of that plane into the Pentagon was to daycare center and obviously many potential pediatric casualties. We had an opportunity to review our own plan, our own institutional plan, and also the whole region had an opportunity to examine our preparedness. And one thing we realized, and actually, Sandy, you mentioned it, is that the ability to communicate is something that we assume on a daily basis. We talk with other hospitals, with other doctors in the area as part of our daily walk all the time, and we rely on it. That day, the communication system was completely overwhelmed, completely overloaded, and our ability to even make the most rudimentary calls to ask how many beds do you have at your place, what is your preparedness, just very fundamental questions was completely lost and overwhelmed. So, you know, we have taken that experience to go back and reframe our institutional plan and also a regional plan to make sure that those things that are absolutely essential to providing services in a disaster circumstance don't go down with the disaster. And with regard to what we can say to families, I think that if we all put ourselves in the situation of being parents and families, what would you do? Well, you would go to the closest place for help. And we understand that that is what is likely to happen. So we feel strongly, for instance, that places that usually take care of adults will have to take care of kids, and places that usually take care of kids are going to have to take care of adults. We believe in family-centered care so that at our facility we would not turn away an injured adult. We believe that if the adult is attached to a child, they need to stay together. So since September 11th, we have been preparing to deal with families together. We are fortunate in that we're co-located on a campus that has other hospitals that can provide care across the age spectrum. And this is actually not an unusual circumstance. There are many communities across the country in which the children's hospital is attached to a general facility or is actually within a general facility, and family-centered care is possible. However, it has to be planned for. A specific example may be something along the lines of how do you decontaminate a family? Well, you have to understand that the child going through a decontamination shower is going to need assistance. And the mechanics of accomplishing a decontamination shower for a toddler or a school-age child will require an extra set of hands for a mother who's trying to make their way. And if there is more than one child, you can imagine the potential complications of that. So those are the kinds of things that I wouldn't say were not contemplated before September 11th, but certainly have been brought to the forefront since September 11th. And facilities all across the country have been going through the same kind of thought processes.
At that time, there were a lot of lists that came across the emails of things you should have at home or things you should have on hand in the event of an emergency in the future. What if you had to pack up and leave your home? Where would you all go? Planning a phone number that your whole family would be in touch with to try to re-find each other. Suggestions along those lines?
Suggestions are all over the map. One of our international colleagues in Israel, who we communicate with professionally quite a bit around these issues, shared with us in their experience that every household actually has a gas mask fitted for each person, even the children, and they encourage the family not to leave the house, to seal themselves in, and each home has such a room. This is not the reality in the United States. However, provides food for thought about how to best handle, and we're not talking about multiple casualty incidents. We're talking about mass casualty, you know, hundreds and hundreds of potential victims, and not even talking, not even including the worried well. The worried well presents a huge challenge. Crowd control. Can you imagine worried parents showing up at a hospital? And the short answer to your question is, I really don't know what a useful list should include. Certainly what you mentioned is essential, communication and contact numbers, and being able to let someone know where you're taking if someone should be injured. One of the advantages we have in this age of technology is that at our facility, for instance, we are planning to use digital photography as a way of reuniting folks.
Are there hospitals across the country that are also at this level of preparedness, or is this something that listeners all over need to call their pediatricians and find out?
Well, certainly hospitals all across the country are going through this kind of preparedness. So yes, those ideas are being shared all across the country.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on what kids need in a national medical emergency.
For an audio cassette copy of any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parent's Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. Today we are talking with Dr. Joseph Wright of the Children's National Medical Center about what kids need in a national or community medical emergency.
Are there any kinds of behaviors that you'd advise as appropriate precautions? We're now talking about parents thinking, well, should I be sure my kid washes his hands every time he comes in from outside? Or should we be sure we have XYZ medication on hand or anything else?
I think just as a basic health preparedness, if you will, we should make sure that our children's routine vaccinations are all up to date. And we need to make sure that as a population, we are protected against those illnesses that are totally preventable. One of the areas that has the potential to be neglected is the mental health of children in these kinds of situations. And this is where parents are really the only people who can be of therapeutic help in these situations. Children are very concrete thinkers. It's something that they might see on the television. They may relate directly to their own life, and parents have to address that. And a lot of that came out after the extensive television coverage of the events of 9/11. Younger children are also fantastic thinkers as well, and their imaginations can run wild when seeing events. So parents need to know where their child is developmentally, how they may interpret things that they see on television, and address them from the child's perspective. And that's where a family pediatrician can help as well.
If we're all nervous and frightened about possible scenarios, what should we be telling our children?
Well, that's truly a difficult challenge. I think, again, it requires parents to have the ability to step back from their own anxiety and their own fears, which is a tough thing to do. And there's a requirement that, fortunately, as parents, we don't have to face every day. But I think it's, again, critically important for parents to talk openly with their children, because trying to shield the child at home can be detrimental, because when the child leaves the home, either to go to school or interact with friends or other people in the community, in this kind of scenario, everyone's going to be talking about it. The child will be receiving information from other sources, and I think it's always best if the primary source of correct information is the parent.
One of the things you mentioned about the digital cameras makes me realize, I don't think we're emphasizing enough, that sometimes in an emergency, the children are nowhere near where the parents are, like in the daycare centers you mentioned.
Yeah. In fact, I believe it's more likely in a scenario that children are going to be separated just because of what children are doing during the course of the day. They're in school, they're in daycare, and that separation factor is one that has to drive preparedness. And it will require anticipating more need for security, crowd control, having public relations people available to answer parents' questions.
Dr. Wright, how do you feel about precautionary use of vaccines for children?
There is a school of thought that says natural immunity is best. Certainly we have some experience with regard to vaccines that have been developed since the three of us were children, and chickenpox being probably the best example, where natural immunity was conferred to us all because we were either exposed to a sibling that had chickenpox, we had chickenpox ourselves, or there were kids in our class that had chickenpox, and we may have had a subclinical infection but didn't necessarily get sick, yet we were immunized in that way. In this time of potential biologic threat, the concern about vaccinating large numbers of people against something like smallpox is being debated how to do it, understanding that this is a scenario in which there is a percentage of people, and children being among the most vulnerable, who will suffer side effects, severe side effects potentially, from the vaccine itself. So you weigh the benefit of protecting an entire community or the entire population against the threat of an actual disease versus literally the sacrifice of a small segment of the population due to complications of the vaccine itself.
Do you see a situation where the vaccines will be available and then sort of first come, first serve, or it will be a mandated thing, all children need to be vaccinated, or how do you see that playing out?
An organized approach and plan to vaccine administration is being contemplated, and that is happening as we speak. How to do it, who will administer the vaccines, where families will need to go, and that is a huge logistical operation even to just think about. I certainly hope that the scenario of having to emergently administer vaccines is not one that we're faced with. Primarily, the way that vaccines work, though, is that they are most effective if administered as prophylaxis ahead of time.
At this point, are there resources that you could suggest for our listeners who might want to learn more about what to do in the event of a national emergency?
Absolutely. There's a very well-referenced and comprehensive resource available at the American Academy of Pediatrics website. It's actually a toolkit for children, terrorism, and disasters. That's the title of it. It's accessible at www.aap.org. And it's available to the public. There's also a federal program called Emergency Medical Services for Children that has been active for a number of years around issues of preparedness and addressing many of the things that we've talked about today. And they are accessible at www.ems-c.org. And lastly, there's a program operating out of our facility at Children's National Medical Center in Washington called the International Center to Heal Our Children that specifically is focused on the mental health of children and families in these times. And certainly we have all been stressed across the country with the threat, and specifically here in our local region with the recent sniper incident. And the International Center to Heal Our Children is accessible through at www.dcchildrens.com.
Well, we appreciate so much Dr. Joseph Wright's visiting with us today to reassure us all that there are things we can do about potential national medical emergencies. Thank you so much, Dr. Wright.
Thank you.
Our gift for our first caller today is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and mention show number 167. Tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our books, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. There are no W's in this site. It's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Andrea Tokic. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.